Important dates in Christian history. 529 AD. Benedict of Nursia establishes his monastic order outside of Rome. His written code of conduct, called the Benedictine Rule, becomes the most influential guide for centuries of monasticism in the West. This is Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
Should pro-lifers work with people of different faiths? Should we even stand on the same stage as them? This is Wretched Radio, and hey, I'm Jimmy Hicks. This is not your typical Wretched Radio. No, we're doing something a bit different today. Todd is actually sitting down with Scott Klusendorf, who's the president of the Life Training Institute and also host of our Life is Best resource, which you can find in the Fortis store right now at fortisinstitute.org. And now the conversation goes into unity and conviction and the gospel.
There is a little bit different scenario, and this may be getting more to the heart of what you sense might be a difference between us. Pretend it's a pro-life rally, like one I went to recently, that was run by the Knights of Columbus. Mm-hmm. And there were clergy from numerous denominations there.
I wouldn't do that.
And they had a rabbi, they had a Catholic, they had, well, several Catholics. They had a mainline pastor who surprisingly was pro-life, mm-hmm. because usually they're not. And then there was me. Mm-hmm. And in one of the remarks from the speaker ahead of me, he did make the case that, well, we basically all agree.
Oh, boy.
And we, you know, we all serve the same God, and mm-hmm. we are all after the, you know.
In our own way.
Yeah, that whole thing. So when I got up, I corrected that. And here's what I said. I did not leave the meeting because I didn't feel that was going to help. What I did is I stood up and I said, men and women, here's the beauty of the pro-life movement. We don't agree theologically. There is a world of difference between major doctrinal points between Catholics and Protestants and Jews. And I said, these beliefs are mutually exclusive. What we can do, though, is we can say that though we disagree theologically, we can act together for the common good of society to save children. That we can do. But we don't have to pretend we agree theologically.
Yeah, if the clarification is made,
it has to be there.
That's a different thing, because the guy in front of you communicated, we're all the same. If nobody says that, I think that's what it does communicate.
Oh, it does.
Here we are, all on the same platform.
If I went up and said nothing, my silence is agreement to that audience.
Right.
I can't do that.
You know what? I'll noodle that a little bit, Scott. The scenario, the picture that you painted.
Yeah.
My Second John 9 concern is this says kumbaya.
Right.
And I don't think we should be conveying that message.
No.
But if I could get up and say, mm-hmm. for the record, we all disagree on one issue, mm-hmm. Jesus Christ, mm-hmm. who he is and what he's accomplished. I'll think about that.
Here's the thing.
And then I'll still disagree and blog about you.
Well, of course. And I'll put nasty stuff up on Twitter. I'm always looking at, is there good I can do where I don't have to compromise my core convictions? And is there a way to do that good without doing that? So, I mean, I'm going to guess, I could be wrong, 70% of my work is with Catholics. It just is.
Now, see, getting fine combed on that.
Yeah.
You and I would agree with that statement. How we determine we're actually achieving that standard.
Yeah.
Let's just for the moment say you and I still disagree.
Right.
Okay. I can at least go, all right, I'll try to think about that.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
You said something. It's like, okay, if I could get up and do a disclaimer.
Right.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But I'm not persuaded at the moment. But you and I actually agree on it. And this is the beauty, I think, of Christendom and the Bible. It's Romans 14. It's 2 Corinthians 8 through 10. These gray areas, the disputable dispensations,
right.
where it kind of gets down to some of the application.
Right.
And we see it differently. Okay, I'm still going to try to persuade you to get off of that platform with that rabbi in the breaks.
Yeah.
But I don't have to
right.
go on the internet and hammer you.
I will still try to persuade you that if you get invited to be on that platform to share your pro-life views, that you would go. And you would issue a disclaimer. And in issuing your disclaimer, you also have an opportunity to bring gospel in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you wonder about the Apostle Paul walking into a situation where he knows he's dealing with godless pagans.
Yeah.
I know there are commentators who make the statement that they think Paul blew it on Mars Hill. I don't think so.
I don't think so.
Yeah. I think Paul knew exactly what he was doing. But here's where I can take the warning from you. And that is, a guy in my position needs brothers who look over my shoulder and say, are you sure you're drawing those distinctives. Mm-hmm. The minute I say, I don't need somebody like you, who maybe sees a little differently, that I can just float without input from people who, you know, I'm just cautious there. I think you get on very dangerous turf.
Yeah, I do too.
So the discussion here is a good reminder for me to say, okay, I'm going to keep going to Catholic schools. I do another one in 2 days. But I'm going to be reminded that that distinctive needs to be there. And right. I must never sacrifice that intentionally for the sake of an appearance of unity.
Speaking of unity, the pro-life movement itself can be fractured.
Uh-huh.
And I have to tell you, I see it as a bit of a bummer, to say the least. Mm-hmm. Specifically, the difference between abolition and incrementalism. Do you know of any pro-life, genuinely pro-life person who does not want abortion abolished?
No.
Okay, so we're on the same page, incrementalists and abolitionists.
Abolitionists and incrementalists agree in principle. We all want abortion abolished now, completely, right. All totally. Children protected. The debate starts when that can't immediately happen.
Mm-hmm.
And abolitionists and pro-lifers have two different starting points once that can't happen.
Mm-hmm. And the sad aspect of that to me is these are people... I know abolitionists. Mm-hmm. I'm an incrementalist like you,
right.
Which doesn't mean we're like thrilled about incremental legislation.
No.
But nevertheless, if babies are getting saved,
right,
we're saving them from the slaughter.
Correct.
Then we're happy about mm-hmm. the lives that were right. saved, but not content until it is obliterated.
No.
Okay. So these are brothers. Would you not agree?
Yes.
And yet, our ability to work together on the life issue has been crippled because of this disagreement. And look, it's a healthy disagreement. It's a substantial one. But wow, it pains me that we divided.
And I do have a couple of abolitionists that are friends of mine that we have fair-minded discussions where mm-hmm. we do not impute to one another the worst possible motives.
Sure.
And we are actually able, you wanted that word, so I was going to bring it in one way or the other. We're able to talk. And here's where abolitionists could really help the movement if they drop this notion that incrementalists have nothing but evil intent. And here's where they help us. There are some pro-life leaders who are just soft and they're not willing to press the envelope at all. They're not willing to take some bold moves. And abolitionists are not wrong to look at that and say, what's wrong with us? What's going on here? Where it gets sticky at that point, if we're looking at pro-lifers who are just cowardly and unwilling to push forward with aggressive bills that will protect children, hey, I'm with the abolitionists, I'm going to critique those pro-lifers. But when we don't have that ability, we do the greatest good we can given the political constraints forced upon us. Right. And we save as many lives as we can. That's not compromise, that's doing the best you can.
All right, let me argue from an abolitionist standpoint. I think your representation of all abolitionists imputing ulterior bad motives to their incremental understanding are all evil. Do they all think that everybody's got horrible motives and they're really not pro-life at all?
The main people do. That's what their blogs say. That's what their websites say. That's what their videos say.
Mm.
A pro-lifer cannot write an article and not have 5 minutes later abolitionists crashing every social media site where the article appears and placing links to their own articles that allegedly refute what was written.
Okay, I'm thinking though right now of the Southern Baptist Convention.
Yeah.
I think a lot of folks there would say, I'm an abolitionist,
mm-hmm.
but they wouldn't look at a Scott Klusendorf and go, you are a bad actor and you have ulterior motives mm-hmm. and you're weak and soft. They wouldn't do that because like most movements, mm-hmm. you've got the leaders mm-hmm. and then the followers
right.
aren't always in lockstep. I would still like to argue, although this is your field more than mine, that the majority of folks will go, yeah, one abolition. They aren't thinking nefarious thoughts about incrementalists.
No, they're not.
Would you say the abolitionists are persisting in sin?
I would say they're mistaken, and I would say they are theologically wrong, and I think they are failing to save babies that could be saved now,
but they
hoping
aren't
for a future.
Living in willful rebellion, trying to maintain a lifestyle of sin.
I'm not accusing them of that.
Good.
I think they're
okay.
mistaken. I'm withholding judgment on that. I can have fellowship with fair-minded abolitionists.
Right.
I don't have to throw them under the bus theologically.
All right, got to interrupt just a second. We are going to continue this conversation with Todd and Scott Klusendorf in just a moment. Not everybody agrees with where to draw the line, and they are going to unpack the tension between strategy and theology coming up next on Wretched Radio. Look, I'm going to be straight with you. Every man knows what it's like to fight a battle no one else can see. You wake up, you're determined that today is going to be different. This time, you're going to be stronger than the temptation. But then evening comes, and there you are again, right back where you started. You're making promises to yourself that you already know deep down that you're not going to keep tomorrow. Here's what no one wants to admit. You can't win this fight with willpower. Trust me, if determination alone could break the chains of lust and sin, you would already be free. You've probably figured that out by now. The filters, the accountability apps, the promises to your wife or to yourself, they're just band-aids on a wound that needs surgery. Real freedom, the kind that actually lasts, it only comes when Christ changes you from the inside out. Not just your habits, but your actual heart. That's what Todd Friel gets into very deeply with his resource, Play the Man. It's available right now as an ebook, an audiobook, and video series only at fortisplus.org. Thanks for listening to Wretched Radio today. At Fortis Institute, we've assembled an incredible team of biblical voices who are equipping believers every day. Dr. John Kratz, Dr. Adam Tyson, Dr. Greg Gifford, Libby Glosson, Pastor Brad Bigney, Dr. Andrew Walker, Jason Lyle, Tim Challies, and of course, our very own Todd Friel. And their work has been invaluable in equipping believers because that's our mission. And the beautiful part, when you join us and link arms with us as an ongoing monthly gospel partner, your faithful giving doesn't just sit there. It multiplies into campus evangelism and biblical counseling, marriage restoration, and gospel proclamation across the globe. And speaking of equipping people, make sure you download Fortis Plus. It is completely free if you haven't downloaded it yet, and it is loaded with hundreds of hours of content, with new content added every single day. No cost, no catch, just solid biblical truth. Look, the fields are white for harvest, and your monthly partnership make it possible. Join us as an ongoing monthly gospel partner right now by visiting fortisinstitute.org. Wretched. Amazing grace, amazing gospel. You know what's annoying? Everyone acts like you should just automatically know how to be a man. Like it's supposed to be obvious or something. And then when you're struggling with temptation or you don't know what you're supposed to be doing with your life, they just say, hey, try harder, pray more. Yeah, I'll do that. Okay, thanks for nothing. Well, Dr. Adam Tyson is actually doing something. He's going to tell you the truth. A brand new Fortis Forum that you can find at fortisplus.org. 5 steps to becoming a man after God's own heart. Dr. Tyson's going to give you real answers from the Bible. Not cliches, not go figure it out for yourself, but actual steps that will tell you and teach you how to fight sin with scripture, how to live with purpose instead of just reacting to whatever happens. Here's the best part. He's going to start with the gospel, so you're not trying to earn God's approval. You're going to be living from his approval. It's on Fortis Plus on demand. You can watch whenever you want at Fortis Forum with Dr. Adam Tyson. And it's free because Fortis Plus is free. Hey, if you're tired of guessing what manhood looks like, just go watch it right now. FortisPlus.org. FortisPlus.org.
Books of the Bible. Nahum, whose name means the Lord comforts, brought a message of comfort to God's people and a prophecy against Nineveh. Nineveh was a powerful city, but they were no match for God. He punished them severely for their wickedness. When you see evil or are tempted towards evil, remember that there are only two possible outcomes: repentance or destruction. This is Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
Abolition or incrementalism? That seems to be the question of the day. This is Wretched Radio. Todd has been talking with Scott Klusendorf, and they're going to continue their conversation now as they tackle one of the biggest divides in the pro-life movement.
In fairness, using the word abolition or abolish more, it's not a bad thing.
No. We're Todd, you and I are both abolitionists in principle, but we are forced to be incrementalists in practice while we continue working to protect all children.
And speaking of forced, was William Wilberforce an abolitionist or an incrementalist?
He was both. He pursued both strategies at the same time. And this is one of my beefs with the abolitionist movement. It's binary. It's not an either or. It can be a both and. Wilberforce pushed for the abolition of the slave trade, which was an incremental step to abolishing slavery in total. He also introduced bills that put regulations on how slave ships were outfitted. Boy, this sounds a whole lot like how we pass laws regulating clinics.
Abortion clinics.
Yeah. And Wilberforce, although committed in principle to being an abolitionist who wanted slavery abolished immediately, still worked incrementally, and the slave trade bill was a classic example of this.
But that kind of, I think, gets us to the crux of the issue, and that is political realities.
Yeah.
What we are able to achieve and what we can achieve can be two different things.
Very.
And to accept that reality, work within that system to try to do the best good that we can, is not to surrender your abolitionist attitude.
No.
Because of political realities. Expand on that a bit.
Well, one of the things you'll hear abolitionists say when incrementalists like us say, listen, the Supreme Court and the federal courts have really handcuffed us on what we can do. They'll say, well, you're surrendering moral authority to the Supreme Court, to a man-made institution, instead of declaring the overriding moral authority of God. And that's...
Okay. Let's not just run past that.
Yeah.
Because that argument has power.
Yes. And I'm about to address it.
Okay.
Yeah. And they're right. God is the overriding moral authority. We as Christian pro-lifers do have moral authority. But to get something done in a constitutional republic, you also need legal authority. You need both. We currently do not have legal authority to protect all children, so we protect as many as we can along the way. While God is clearly the ultimate moral authority, for whatever reason, in his sovereign purposes, we have not been given by him ultimate legal authority to protect all human lives. And why God has done that, I don't know his reasons.
That's the way he set the place up.
It is what it is.
Governments are ministers.
So I will continue working for legal authority as part of a constitutional republic, and I'm not going to quit until all children are protected or I die.
All right. How much of the disagreement between abolitionists and incrementalists do you think resides in eschatology?
I have seen a lot of abolitionists, they are essentially theonomists in terms of that theonomy is their worldview. They view that the kingdom of God now and the authority of God now, it seems to be the foundation. I'm not going to say they're all that way. I think that would be too broad a brush, but that does seem to be their view, as opposed to maybe someone like a Douglas Moo and others who would argue that we have a discontinuity between the Mosaic law that Israel was obliged to live under and what believers today live under and what republics like ours would live under. So there is that dispute that's idling there. I'm not sure how many people in the general public are aware of that or even know the fine distinctives.
Well, if you are a theonomist,
right,
that argument
makes sense.
Make perfect sense.
Right.
If you do not believe eschatologically that there are two kingdoms, that it's one kingdom, and we should be seeking to have God's kingdom reign on earth today. Mm-hmm. Well, then the argument that we're ceding moral authority would be right.
Well, I don't know that it has to be right. Does it necessarily follow from that?
The supposition,
I
believe is not correct. Therefore, the conclusion isn't. But
correct.
If you were going to accept the supposition, then the conclusion. I think they're consistent in that regard.
They are. And the irony of the incremental versus abolitionist approach is that all of us are incrementalists. We're all abolitionists and we're all incrementalists.
Okay.
I consider myself a principled incrementalist. I am an abolitionist in principle, but I will work pragmatically to save as many children as I can along the way.
Well, you know what, though? I don't think I like the word pragmatically there.
Well, let me define. I think pragmatic gets a bad rap.
But pragmatism, depending on how you want to shade the subject, it justifies the means because of a good end. I don't think incrementalism is that, though.
No. Well, let me take an issue with pragmatism here. Pragmatic can mean I'm the governor of a state and I have the means to outlaw abortion. And I don't do it because I think, you know, men will be men. You know, they have certain urges. They're not going to be able to control their sex lives. And, you know, we got to live in the real world here. And if we outlaw abortion, you know, there's going to be pragmatic impact that goes with that. And therefore, I veto a pro-life bill that would have protected all children. But suppose I am in a state where support for legal abortion is overwhelming. And I don't have the votes to protect all children. So I do the greatest good I can, given the situation I'm forced to work with.
See, I wouldn't define that as pragmatism.
We could haggle over the definition. You're correct that there's a sense where pragmatism eclipses objective moral obligation, where we say, I'm just going to be pragmatic and I'm not going to think about what my...
Because I want this, I'm willing to do that.
Yeah, that's shot through with compromise. But can pragmatic also mean prudent in the sense I do the greatest good I can, given
sure,
the hand that
I guess semantically it could. I think I think to avoid any of the ditches, I think prudent is exactly
I'm fine
correct.
With you substituting that word.
All right. So the Southern Baptist Convention came out with a statement. You weren't nuts about it. Mm-hmm. You wrote an article trying to persuade abolitionists to understand we're not trying to be evil here.
Right.
Was the argument not just in defense of, but for incrementalism? And I believe it was the story of a politician in India?
That was actually a different article, but we can work with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I made up a contrived story, a politician named Ahmad, who is...
Middle East.
Yeah, Middle East. And he's appalled at sex slavery in his country. And especially little girls that are traditionally sold into sex slavery at age 7. And for 10 years, they are living with an older man who, of course, is using them for sexual gratification. And then at age 18, they are sold back to the father who then sells them to other men in marriage. And Ahmad is just horrified at this, but he doesn't have the votes to ban it. But the new parliament, he does have the votes to restrict this practice with all girls who were born nationally in that country. He can't do it for foreigners who live there, but that's going to save 97% of the girls in the country. And he's got the votes for that, and the prime minister is going to sign it. Well, on the eve of the vote, two of his fellow parliamentarians come to him and say, we can't support this. We cannot consent to the sex slavery of those that are unprotected by this bill. And unless this bill protects everybody, we cannot in good faith sign on to it. We must abolish this immediately.
100%.
So that next Saturday, there was a big auction coming up where all these girls were going to be sold. And 30,000 of them. If the bill is signed into law, that auction doesn't happen. If it is signed into law, every one of those girls has new homes on Sunday morning with new masters. The two parliamentarians do not see it Ahmad's way, and they vote against the bill. And that Saturday, all those young girls have new homes and new masters. Was that really the right thing to do? And that's the problem with looking at this in the way that a lot of abolitionists look at this. You're basically sacrificing children now who could be saved in hopes that you can roll the dice and save them later.
The response that I hear, though, and you kind of tagged this earlier that I think might actually be helpful, is that there are people, though, in the incrementalist movement, the pro-life movement, it's like, come on, where's any backbone whatsoever? And has this legislation really, they will actually, though, argue that this incremental legislation hasn't saved babies.
Yeah,
Yeah. What do you say?
Well, that's not the information I've seen. First of all, there's research by Dr. Michael New and others who have indicated that incremental bills have saved some lives. In fact, they estimate that the Hyde Amendment, which cut off federal tax dollars for abortion in 1976, has saved upwards of nearly 2 million lives. That's not a small number.
No.
And now, I'm not going to claim, as some would, that this legislation is just saving boatloads of lives. I don't think we can make that claim. But abortion rates have dropped. And one of the reasons why they're dropping is clinics are closing. These incremental bills do handcuff clinics. And keep in mind, the people running these clinics are profit driven. And when legislation comes in that cuts into their profit margin, they want to
their business.
They want to do something else.
And that is going to do it for today's episode of Wretched Radio. Thank you so much for listening. This conversation that you've been listening to with Todd and Scott Klusendorf is not nearly finished. And you can listen and even watch this conversation in its entirety at FortisPlus.org. And until tomorrow, go serve your king.